So you got married in Gibraltar.
Yes, I think the how we got together is interesting, because it used to be the custom that all the young people would go down to Main Street each night, and we'd all walk up and down Main Street. The boys, you know, be two or three of them friends, we'd walk together down, and the girls would be walking the other way. And then you got to like one of the girls, so those two groups would get together. So you'd have three or four boys and three or four girls walking up and down, and the two that wanted to get together would get together, you know. And they'd be walking up and down until after a while, they split off and everything else went together. And the first day that my wife, that Lillian and I walked up and down by ourselves, both of us, when we got home, our parents said to us, "Who is that you were with?"
So how did they know? So that's what it's like.
I don't know. And when I wanted to get engaged to Lillian, I had to get my father-in-law, take him to a bar for a coffee, and ask permission to enter the house. Today they're in bed before they do that.
No, it's true though. I know, it's so formal. So I was asking Lillian about, you know, what did her parents, were her parents frightened of her, you know the sailors and everything, wondering, all these drunk sailors. And she said, well, they were always in before 9 o'clock.
Right, yes.
I mean, it's astounding, isn't it? Mm. Extraordinary.
That's right.
Yeah, that's really. So I've talked a little bit about that. So obviously, you quite soon after this, that is a great story. It wasn't long before you got the job with Shell, was it?
Well, I finished my apprenticeship in 1952, but I'd actually been to see the general manager. I mean, being an innocent young chap, I just walked up to the office and said, "Could I see the manager?" And she said, "What do you want him for?" I said, "Well, you know, I'd like to join." But as it happened, just as I was talking to her, he came out of the office. And he was an ex-Royal Navy commander. He was actually involved in the Pluto pipeline on D-Day. And he was the manager. And he said, "What do you want?" So I said to him that, you know, I was looking for a job. He says, "Well, come in." And he asked me what I was. I said I was an apprentice engineer and that sort of thing. And he started talking about some drawings on the desk, obviously to find out, you know, what I was doing, what I knew. And I started asking some questions and so forth. And he said, "Right," he said, "when do you finish?" I said, "September 52. He said, "Right, you've got to do your national service, which is 6 months. And he said, a week before you finish your national service, give me a ring." So I did that. And he said, "Right, Saturday morning you start." And that was it. And I worked 2 years as assistant engineer on a tanker in Gibraltar. And then the chap that was running the airport, his son had a hole in the heart. So the Shell decided to send him to the UK so that the child could have his thing sorted out. And they asked me to take over the airport. I spent 6 years working at the airport. And then they sent me to Nigeria.
That's, sorry, I was just going to ask you another question about when you talked about national service.
Yes.
So is this the same national service that was going on in the UK? So was it an English initiative?
No.
So it was Gibraltar.
It was Gibraltar Defence Force, which is now the Royal Gibraltar Regiment. We had to do 6 months national service in Gibraltar. And we were, at my time, we were actually Royal Artillery attached to the 54th ACAC. And we did 6 months national service, where we did normal marching and drills and that. Then we were doing anti-aircraft guns, predictors and things of that sort. And some of the other intakes actually fired the 9.2s on the top of the rock. Then at the end of that, we were supposed to do 2 weeks every 2 years to sort of just keep up to date. But in fact, when I did the first lot of 2 weeks, another story, I was, we used to go up the rock, and our barracks was on a very, very steep hill at Buena Vista. And in Gibraltar, because the roads got very hot, the tarmac would melt, and the stones that were in the tarmac would come through. And we were wearing hobnail boots. So we were coming down the hill to try and get into our barracks. It was incredible. We were slipping all over the place. So I went to see the colonel, who was an English 54th ACAT colonel, and I said to him, look, we're having a lot of trouble with our boots. We can't keep our feet up the rock. I said, why can't we wear the rubber-soled boots? And his answer was, if it's good enough for the British Army, it's good enough for you. About a week later, I was up the rock on a night exercise, and I was coming down one of the steep hills up the rock, and I slipped, carrying a heavy gun, and I slid down the hill, sitting on my ankle, with my knee sort of feigning forward, and I came up against a rock with my knee, and split my kneecap in two. So I spent 3 months in hospital, and so I was medically unfit, so I was discharged.
So you were right, anyway.
Oh, I was definitely right, but they didn't make any difference.
No. But was there a... I mean, obviously there still is. I mean, you know, the evidence. When did the servicemen start leaving?
I'm not sure.
I mean, obviously the naval base was there, but the gunners and everything must have left in... I don't know.
I'm not too sure of that sort of information.
I was just thinking about this sort of, you know, when you go around the English coastline, for example, you know, in Cornwall, I've done some work at Pendennis Castle, you know, in Falmouth, I don't know if it would be there, but, you know, that was an enormous gun battery, and, I don't know if it's only me talking, and, you know, it's almost... You can totally imagine the British. You've still got the pegs. You almost imagine someone to come and hang their coat up there. It's quite ghostly, really.
Yes.
It's not that long ago.
Well, in Gibraltar, it's a bit different because what's happened is that a lot of the military barracks and so forth have been taken over and converted into civilian housing. For example, the barracks, South Barracks, is now a school. A lot of the married quarters have been converted into civilian houses, and there isn't much evidence now of the military presence as such, other than the fortifications that have been there since the year dot.
One other thing I want to ask you, which you may or may not know, is how long did National Service continue?
I'm not absolutely sure. I think the last would have been somewhere in the late 60s, I would think.
So about the same as
about
the UK?
Well, it would have been the same time as the UK,
right,
yes.
Right, okay.
Because I'd gone from Gibraltar there by that stage, because I was sent away in 62 to Nigeria. So what happened from 62, I can only go by what I've read.
Of course. No, I understand that. And we're going to stop the story there because it would be fascinating to talk to you about Nigeria and Papua New Guinea, but we'll be able to start tomorrow. So I just wanted to ask you some last bits, if that's okay. And they're just sort of very obvious, but just general questions. Because, obviously, you know, you have an enormous connection with Gibraltar and you go over there. I mean, what do you feel? Do you feel sort of British, Spanish, Gibraltarian?
We are Gibraltarian first, British second. There's no argument about that. And British, not English. You see, the big problem we've got is to explain to foreigners the difference between British and English.
You can explain that to me, actually.
Because as I spend a lot of time in French-speaking Africa, they were always saying to me, are you English? I said, no, I'm British. Well, what's the difference? I said, well, to be English, you've got to be born in England.
Oh, okay. I thought, you see, it's funny. See, I haven't even got that. When I think people talk about British, they're talking about, you know, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. Not British in the most enormous. That's very British. Interesting.
Yes.
Yes, of course.
That's what annoys me when the people on the radio say that Britain stood alone, like hell they did. A third of the world was painted pink at that stage. If it hadn't been for Australia, New Zealand, India, Africa, all the different other colonies.
Jamaica.
Well, all the other colonies. Mm. I mean, Britain wouldn't have had a foot to stand on.
I know. I mean, it's such a story. I mean, even the stuff that's going on now about these commemorations of the First World War, there's an enormous amount of help. I mean, were there actually, there must have been Gibraltarians then in the British Army?
In every single fight that's been in, that Britain has had since Gibraltar became, say, called the 1800s, there has always been Gibraltarians involved. Whether it was South Africa with the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Sarajevo, Afghanistan. In fact, a couple of our people have just were given medals in Africa, in Iraq. The chaplain of the British Army in Iraq is Gibraltarian.
Is there a war memorial in Gibraltar?
Yes, there's two war memorials. There's one for the First World War, and there's the Cross of Sacrifice, which is for everything else. And there's also a military cemetery in Gibraltar.
And do you think, I mean, this is sort of a final question, really. I mean, how do you think sort of young Gibraltarians, like, you know, your grandchildren's generation, but people who actually live in Gibraltar now, I mean, what is there, do they have a connection with the history, or certainly the wartime history, do you think, at all?
A watered-down version, yes. Because obviously they didn't go through, all they know is what their parents have told them. But one thing I will say is that Gibraltar are very proud of being Gibraltarian. If you ever get a chance to go to Gibraltar on September 10th, you'll realise what patriotism means. Everybody comes out in red and white on that day, which is our flag. After the war, I joined the Sea Scouts, and as a result of Operation Torch in 1942, all the aircraft that Spitfires were brought in Spitfires and Hurricanes were brought in boxes and assembled in Gibraltar. So there was a lot of wood lying around and boxes lying around. A lot of the boxes were turned into accommodation for the additional troops that were there for the operation, but of course after that there was a lot of wood that was not needed, and a lot of the RAF built themselves sailing boats out of the wood. When I returned from England and had joined the Sea Scouts, my friend and I, we bought a sailing boat each at the cost of £5, made from the Spitfire cases.
Great, thank you.